Welcome to Few and Far Between, conversations about rare disease research. I'm your host, Wayne Bowden. Okay, so we're switching up a bit on this episode. For those of you who have grown tired of my voice already, you're going to get a little bit of a break. On today's podcast, BioRassi's own Raul de Souza Silveira will be leading the conversation. Raul currently serves as the head of program development in Europe. He is a clinical consultant, scientist, and lecturer, and a very valued member of our BioRassi team over there in Germany. So welcome, Raul, to the array of esteemed hosts. On this episode, you spoke with David Edward Rose. Can you tell us a little bit about David and what you two talked about?
Hi, Wayne. Thank you for the kind introduction. It will be my pleasure to give you a bit of an intro here into our conversation with David. The meeting with David was really, truly interesting. It highlights the challenges a person living with rare disease can encounter on a daily basis. David is really a true inspiration, demonstrating how he turned every obstacle in his life into a positive outcome. He works in the business development at the Rare Revolution magazine. He's an ultra-rare disease patient speaker and trustee for Mitrofanov Support. He's also a speaker for the National Organization for Rare Disorders Interactive and Virtual Living Rare. He recently participated in their Living Stronger Patient and Family Forum that took place just last month. David is a business economics graduate from Lord Ashcroft International Business School in Cambridge, with a demonstrated history of public speaking to large audiences, with years of experience volunteering at Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital. David has an ultra-rare condition himself, which is called occipital horn syndrome. We discuss not only the science behind this condition, but how it affects him daily and how it has affected his education, career, and friendships. We have also talked about how the disease etiology and state of research are currently playing out, as well as how he's been overcoming barriers when living with an ultra-rare disease throughout his whole life, as well as the impact of the pandemic for people dealing and living with a rare disease. And as a last note, please excuse any background noises throughout the conversation. We have tried our best to fix those, and we really truly hope that you enjoy our talk.
That's really great content, Raul, and it's always important to have the perspective of patients actually living with these diseases like David is. It sounds like a great conversation, and so without further delay, let's get into your discussion with David right now.
David, welcome to our Few and Far in Between podcast. We're delighted to have you as our guest today. And among other things, we're going to be talking about a condition called occipital horn syndrome, which is actually classified as an ultra-rare disease. More specifically, though, we'll be shedding a light into a personal story. Well, truly your story, David, which I believe it will be of great interest to our listeners. Most of it because, you know, is a story of overcoming adversity, perseverance, and ultimately, actually, never giving up, right? But before we dive into this very exciting story of yours, let's perhaps start with a brief personal introduction, if you don't mind, and then you can tell us a little bit more about the etiology of the condition and some of the associated pathophysiological traits.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ron. Thank you, BioRassi, for this opportunity to speak to you and your listeners today. So I have an ultra-rare condition called occipital horn syndrome. I'm in the UK. I'm the only person in the UK, as far as I know, with this condition. It's really ultra-rare. I found four other people kind of scattered around the rest of Europe, but it's really quite an unusual condition. It's linked to kind of a couple of more kind of common rare diseases. So it's linked to something called Menkes disease and also something called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. So it used to be considered an ultra-rare subtype of Ehlers-Danlos, but now it's its own thing. So it's unusual having this condition part of life now, and it's something that I've just had to learn to live with.
Right. Absolutely. So can you tell us a little bit more about the current state of science surrounding this condition, if any? You know, an ultra-rare disease, I would not be surprised if there's very little evidence on that topic.
There isn't really that much, to be honest with you. So as I said just a second ago, it's linked to something called Menkes disease. So occipital horn syndrome is classed as a mild version of Menkes. So Menkes is a really horrible condition. You don't tend to live past sort of 15, 18 years old. It's a really, you know, it's a really nasty condition. With my condition, it's a milder version. So, you know, things with life expectancy, it's a little bit different. I don't think it's something that you can really measure just because of the amount of people that have it. I don't think it's a big enough sample to really think about that. But in terms of the actual science, there isn't really anything going on. There is gene therapy for Menkes disease, as far as I know. But obviously, that's the sort of slightly different condition. And it's obviously aimed at children and toddlers. So as a sort of 32-year-old man, I'm kind of beyond that stage. So there's not a huge amount. So the condition itself is treated kind of in the same way as someone that had Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, so sort of things like physiotherapy, hydrotherapy, you know, gym activities, pain relief, but there isn't really any kind of science behind it. Some of the research that's actually on the condition, some of it is actually on me as a sample anyway, so I haven't found tons and tons of research. Hopefully that might change at some point and it might end up being a condition that's still really rare, but might not be as rare as you think. And it might be, a lot of people might be misdiagnosed, because I was technically misdiagnosed with something slightly different. So I think obviously through the genetic testing, that will help identify more people maybe with the condition. But certainly as it stands now, kind of from a research and science perspective, there isn't really a whole lot. And in terms of kind of pharmaceutical companies, that's the same as well, because for a pharmaceutical company, they're probably not going to have much interest in such an ultra rare condition without any real sort of reason to. So I've kind of accepted that for now. But yeah, we'll see what happens in the future.
Right, absolutely. It is a challenging scenario, without a doubt. And perhaps we can go into a little bit more depth later on in the podcast on why that has been the case so far. You've touched on a few points already. Not a lot of interest, perhaps not a lot of money to be generated out of that. So, but let's dive into that a little bit later on. And perhaps we can start to talk about some of your professional background and your role as a current employee of the Rare Revolution magazine. You're also a speaker and advocate at NORD. And perhaps you can combine that with the path that has led you to dispositions to this stage where you find yourself currently, and allude a little bit more about, you know, some of the battles that you have fought in the past in terms of, you know, fighting for equality, prejudice that you most likely have faced throughout your life. So can you elaborate a little bit on that, please, for us?
Yeah, it's a great question. So kind of going back a few years now, when I was at university, studied economics, I always wanted to kind of work in finance or banking after graduating. After kind of a year or so of interviews and all the kind of normal graduate pathways, I managed to get myself a job in finance in London. Didn't really work out. I think it's a hard job for anyone if you're healthy, let alone if you're not healthy, trying to do these crazy hours and the sort of stressful job. So that didn't really work out for me. Kind of for context, in my early 20s, I had quite a bit of a rough health time physically, but also I think mentally as well. I don't think I realized maybe to the point of how sort of stressed and sort of health anxiety and health related depression that I had. I think growing up, I kind of dismissed my health as much as I could. Always knew that I was different to my friends and family, but I think I tried to push it back like a lot of men do. I think lots of men are terrible at kind of talking about mental health. But I think especially with living with a rare disease and always kind of being back and forth from hospital, I don't think I maybe realized how depressed I actually was. So I think that this all kind of came at once. I think it was really, you know, your early 20s when you graduate, it's quite an interesting time for anybody. I think a lot of people change and don't really know what they want to do. But obviously when you combine that with being really unwell at the same time, and it was university right at the very end, was a real stress because I had a few major surgeries kind of whilst I was at university. So that kind of threw everything in. I mean, it really kind of changed my mind what I wanted to do. After kind of leaving that job, I think I had I don't know if you'd call it a breakdown as such, but mentally I just kind of gave up, I think. And I was so exhausted with being ill, and I think I just was really frustrated. I really, really kind of reached the bottom, I think, of my patience. But kind of a couple of years after that, I started volunteering for Great Ormond Street Hospital. So for those of you who don't know, Great Ormond Street is a really famous hospital. It's a paediatric hospital in London. I spent lots of time there kind of from about 2 years old up until about 17, 18, really wanted to try and give something back. Didn't have the money to give back, but had my time. And I think time is equally as important as money, definitely in terms of sort of charity work. So I started helping out with a few different things. So that was the time when I was still considered a young person. Obviously, I'm not classed as a young person anymore, but joined a few sort of young person panels, which was really interesting. It was kind of a chance to talk about some of our experiences, kind of growing up, you know, using all the hospital facilities and some of the really interesting work that happens there, especially for rare disease and sort of chronic illnesses. So I really enjoyed doing that. That kind of led to doing some other sort of volunteer work for the charity. And then that's kind of where the public speaking side of my life came from, I guess. So didn't really plan to kind of go that way, but I did a couple of talks to start with for the charity for different events. So lots of kind of big banking companies and publishing companies in the UK used to have, or still do have, Great Ormond Street as their kind of charity of the year. So I used to go in and do big talks, kind of like after dinner speech, I guess. Half of the talk was kind of about where the money was going and how the fundraising was used. And then second part of it was kind of my experiences of being in hospital all the time as a child and what it was like missing lots of school and how I found working, all sorts of things. And you know, I have dealt with friendships and relationships, all the kind of usual things that anybody would deal with. So that's kind of how I started doing the sort of public speaker. It wasn't really planned at all. At the time I was living in Cambridge, and obviously Cambridge is one of our main sort of rare disease hubs in the UK. So there's always millions of rare disease events that's going on, whether that's sort of charities or kind of industry-led events. You know, started doing a few more things. I was asked to come speak at this event and do this event. So it's just a really interesting opportunity. It's something that, you know, I wasn't planning on doing. But that was a really cool chance to sort of talk about my rare disease. I think that was, you know, I was never really one before then to talk about it with my friends or even on social media. Like, I didn't really want that kind of attention from it. So it was a nice chance to kind of vent and to kind of connect with other people. You know, kind of attending all these different events, I've met some really interesting people, you know, even years ago, before I kind of really became involved properly with rare disease. But for the last 3 years, I've been working for Rare Revolution magazine. For those of you who don't know, it's a rare disease magazine based in the UK. So it's founded by two sisters. One of them's son has a really rare skin condition called xeroderma pigmentosum. They've been running a patient group for the last few years and obviously set the magazine up 5 years ago now. So that's a real pleasure to work for them, and something that has made my life so much easier in terms of work, because it's the first kind of job that I've had where I've genuinely had an understanding of bosses that really get what it's actually like to live with a rare disease. I think a lot of people living with a rare disease struggle with work for many reasons. Lots of people are kind of underemployed, where they have so many qualifications but they can't use it in the role they would like to use, or they're not working for various reasons. So I feel really grateful to have a job where I feel like I'm giving back and I'm connecting with lots of different rare disease stakeholders literally all over the world. It's really nice to kind of connect with them and see what people are doing. So yeah, it's funny how life has sort of panned out. I didn't really expect to be working kind of in rare disease at all, but definitely wouldn't change it for anything. It's really, you know, it's a really exciting opportunity for me.
Yeah, wonderful. What an interesting story. It's really amazing, the path that, you know, life takes a person to pursue, and the wonderful things, in spite of all odds, that, you know, end up happening. It is really a truly inspirational story, this one of yours. And to go a little bit more into depth, obviously dealing with an ultra rare condition is a little bit different than dealing with a rare disease itself. Can you elaborate a little bit more on the main differences between having an ultra rare and having a rare disease?
Yeah, that's another good question. So I'll give you kind of my initial thoughts. So probably the most obvious one really is kind of general understanding, even within the medical field. So some rare diseases, the sort of general society might have, you know, things like cystic fibrosis and haemophilia, because they're spoken about in mainstream society, people have heard of them. So they're kind of like a common rare disease. If you kind of flip back to mine, which is a really ultra rare disease, it's, you know, nobody's heard of my condition until I've told them about it, obviously. And I wouldn't expect them to, you know, there's sort of between 7,000 and 8,000, I guess, rare diseases now. So, you know, there's so many, I wouldn't expect anyone to understand what it is. So it's a challenge, I guess, kind of. When I see like our GP, like our local doctors here in the UK, you know, they know about it now because they've met me, but meeting that general doctor, you know, even rare disease specialists, you know, wouldn't have heard of it before. So when you see your kind of like your general practitioner, it's quite difficult. Even things like going to the dentist, that requires a slightly different work because of how I react to anaesthetic and things. So kind of any part of any healthcare is really difficult. I guess in terms of kind of connecting with other people, when you have like an ultra rare condition, quite often there's not a patient group or there's no kind of community or there's no interest from pharma or anything like that. So I guess that's another kind of thing that I'm realizing now is that, you know, since I've been working in rare disease and volunteering kind of for the last few years now, you know, I've met lots of people from different patient groups and you know, some of the bigger rare diseases have like multiple chapters within, you know, like in the States, there's kind of multiple hemophilia groups, whereas there isn't a population of people really for my condition. There's a scattering kind of here and there, but there isn't, you know, like a registered charity or anything. So that's another kind of battle. And I guess kind of if I wasn't working for the magazine, awareness in terms of like in education and workplaces. So I think because it's a hidden, I would call it a hidden condition, and it's not hidden at the same time. So it's hidden in the sense that you can't really see the problems of my bladder and kidney and heart and everything, but you can see the problems in my joints and the way that I walk and the way I hold pens and things like that. So there is, it's kind of like a two-tiered thing. I wouldn't call it hidden completely. But that kind of hidden condition and the kind of the unpredictable side of things makes everything really difficult, because it's not as simple as, you know, have a busy one day and then the next day you have a rest day, because it doesn't really work like that. It's so random and every day is so completely different. So everything is affected, you know, it literally affects your, you know, your work, your friendships, relationships, you know, everything. So something that, you know, now I know the name of the condition and I know kind of exactly what I'm dealing with, I think that makes it a little bit easier. But yeah, general life still takes a little bit more planning and organizing, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly very, very challenging. You know, if I was to sum up everything, so we have, you know, a lack of online information and general resources. There is a lack of patient groups, advocacy groups, registries, and really a hard battle to be fought whenever it comes to diagnosis and treatment, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's, I think going back to the patient groups, I think that's something that, you know, there are obviously lots of patient groups for really small populations like mine. But I think it's people don't realize the amount of work that actually goes into running a patient group. You know, I've had the pleasure of meeting a lot of people. A lot of them tend to be parents or siblings of somebody with a rare disease, purely because it takes so much work to do it. It's a real, there's so much kind of legal work and, you know, and fundraising, and you have to be so organized. And being honest, I don't think I'd have the energy to do it. Not on top of what I already do. So, you know, I've always thought about maybe, you know, because somebody somewhere has got to start the first patient group. You know, that's how I always see it. But I probably don't have the energy to do it, to be honest.
So, David, we are all facing a very challenging time in the face of COVID nowadays. I'm sure that COVID is affecting us at different levels, and surely it has been having an impact on the rare disease scene, not only for patients, but for doctors and treatment centers. So can you allude a little bit into those aspects, you know, the daily battles, the challenges, and some of the effects that you have been noticing, which are taking place due to current pandemic that we are all living on at the moment?
Yeah, sure. So I'll answer this kind of in a personal capacity, I think. So for me personally, I found COVID quite a battle in terms of actually more so like day-to-day appointments and procedures, scans, that kind of thing. So they've been, you know, this is purely just from my own perspective, lots of appointments have become telemedicine, which I'm not convinced works for everything. I think it works for a lot of appointments, but some things you really just need to see a doctor. And I think that's been, you know, I obviously completely understand why that's the case. But, you know, people with a rare disease tend to have, you know, really regular appointments. That's kind of the nature of a rare disease. You tend to have kind of multiple different doctors at multiple different hospitals. You know, that's really common. So to have everything stop has been more overwhelming to me. Obviously, this is kind of, things are changing a bit now, but kind of going back a few months, that was more overwhelming and stressful to me than I found COVID initially. So, you know, I completely get why that was the case, but that's just from my perspective. Even things like kind of seeing like my local GP, that was really quite stressful as well, because they're kind of the gatekeepers to everything, but we haven't been able to have face-to-face appointments for months. I think it's only just starting to come back. And even then, they're very hesitant to do anything. Even things, so as part of my condition and as part of a lot of people's condition, I have to have regular sort of blood and urine tests. Haven't been able to have any of them done locally, so I've had to travel everywhere, which seems very counterintuitive when you're supposed to not be traveling, but you're traveling something that you could do 10 minutes walk from your house. So things like that have been quite frustrating. You know, this is just purely from my own perspective. You know, I don't speak for everybody by any means. I think a lot of people kind of broadly speaking in the rare disease community have found it very difficult. You know, I don't have an autoimmune condition, so I wasn't classed as clinically vulnerable, like what we've called it in the UK. So I wasn't quarantining at home. I was staying in, but I wasn't kind of staying in for months on end. So I think that my viewpoint might be, well, will be different from a lot of people. I think broadly speaking, a lot of people found it really scary because if you have an autoimmune condition, COVID is obviously extremely dangerous to you. So I think people have found it very difficult and also very isolating as well, because again, it's a strange one because quite often having a rare disease is isolating anyway. So it's, I think people may have seen like the kind of healthier population now they're experiencing COVID and, you know, all the things that have come with it. It's in a strange way, it's almost like a glimpse into what it's like to actually be someone with a chronic illness or a rare disease, because, you know, for many people, you know, lots of people don't leave the house for weeks at a time or, you know, months at a time even. So actually it's a strange way to look at it, but I think it's been an eye-opener for some people, some healthy people that don't have the knowledge of what it's like to be ill and, you know, always at home. So, you know, I found it stressful really more so just for the, I think for broadly speaking, I think a lot of people have really struggled with COVID. And I think that things are maybe getting a little bit better, but we're far from, you know, there just yet.
Right. David, you were, you know, a few minutes ago, you were alluding to the fact that, you know, having a rare disease, you know, oftentimes you find yourself alone. There's a huge psychological component, which is really hard to deal with when having such a burden. And, you know, my personal question to you, if you don't mind, and how do you deal with that? How do you, you know, generate this inner strength in order to overcome such adversities? You know, for our listeners, you know, if there's someone listening out there facing some of the same challenges that you do face on a daily basis, is there anything that you think you could share with us in terms of empowerment on how to deal with this and really have that positive approach to life? Being a healthy person, most of the times you will probably not even come close to understanding what it's really like to have such a hard to deal with condition. So where do you take this positive attitude from?
Oh, very, very good question. I think it's a mix of things. So quite often people ask, or I've seen it kind of poses a question within the rare community, like, do you think it's easier to have a condition, like a genetic condition that you're born with and something that you've been unwell with all of your life? Or is it easier to have been healthy for say 40 years and then become unwell in your early 40s? So because I've always been unwell, you know, it's kind of been in cycles. You know, I've been kind of really poorly for 5 years and then well for a couple of years and then well in inverted commas. And it's always been in cycles. It's never really been any different to that. So because I don't actually know what it's like to be healthy as such, I've never known any difference. So I think that probably builds a character in some ways because I'm used to challenging, or I'm used to having challenges put upon me. So, you know, I've got no option but strive to do the best I can because this condition is a degenerative condition. It's not going anywhere. It's really up to me, like, to make the most of what I have. I think it's been very frustrating. I'm far from accomplishing kind of the best, you know, mindset by any means, but I think that kind of at different points in my life it's become harder. But I think it's, I don't want to sound sort of too like poetic, but I think like when you've had some really bad low points, you tend to kind of grow back a bit stronger. I certainly found that I have. So when I really admitted probably how much of a mental health, you know, pit I was in, I think that probably built character because I think I didn't really realize it or didn't want to accept it. And again, like, a lot of men are really bad, going back to this, a lot of men are really terrible at talking about health and especially mental health because it's had such a stigma, and thankfully mental health kind of awareness is getting a lot better now. Again, it's not amazing, but it's getting more well known and more people are talking about it, which is really good. I think that my mental health has been definitely lower at different points, but that's probably pushed me on. So I think that because, you know, now I know the name of this condition that I have. So I've always known a condition when I was younger, but never really confirmed what it was. But now I know it's a genetic condition. I know exactly kind of what it is. I think that's probably helped. I'm very thankful for all of my friends and my family and colleagues and girlfriend. everybody, anyone that I've kind of met has really helped inspire me and push me to do things. I've always kind of pushed myself as much as I can. I think that in itself can be dangerous because you've got to kind of be realistic about what you can and can't do. I think it's a really fine line between pushing yourself and having like dreams and ambitions, but not being too unrealistic that you'll get disappointed when they don't come true. So I think it's just about being realistic and, you know, doing as much as you can. I think there's lots of things, so things like social media, be careful to not spend too much time, especially comparing yourself to other people. That's, you know, that's whether you're healthy or poorly, that's one of the worst things you can do. And I think I was really bad at that when I was younger, and I've kind of realized now that everyone is very different. And I think that probably because of the age I am now, like, I think obviously, you know, I'm in my early 30s now, I'm not 18 anymore. I think I've kind of understood maybe a bit more about what I want from life, and it's not all about earning loads of money or anything like that. It's more about doing, you know, things that make you happy. And, you know, I found what makes me happy now. You know, I didn't think it would be working in rare disease and doing what I'm doing, but that's definitely what I really enjoy doing. So, you know, I'm very thankful that I found something that kind of gives me a purpose and gives me a drive each day, because it doesn't even really feel like work. That's when you know you found the right career path, when it doesn't feel like work anymore, because you just love what you do. So I think I'm very lucky that my kind of network around me and my career path has been very fortunate, and I'm fully aware that that's not the same for everyone. Kind of pre-COVID, it was nice to kind of go on trips and kind of be active as much, you know, do things and have things to look forward to. I'm really looking forward to doing that again. People really underestimate, you know, I used to go to football games with my dad quite a lot, and used to go just like little things like going for coffee with friends. Like, it seems really small, but actually when COVID hit and when you wasn't able to do that, I really struggled with that. I think with my rare disease, I kind of get by each day by having things to look forward to, whether it's a small thing or a big thing. I really struggled with COVID from not necessarily worrying about COVID as such. It was more the isolation of not being able to do anything. I think that was more for me how I struggled. And so, but yeah, just kind of being as active as possible, doing as many things as I can, both for sort of my mental health and my physical health, has been really positive. I hope that makes sense. It's probably me rambling a little bit, but that's kind of how I see it.
No, it absolutely makes sense, David. And, you know, to be honest with you, this is really, really inspiring. And I can't help to, you know, this is very contagious as well, to have this motivation and seeing this inner strength coming out of you is really, really inspiring. And there's a quote that I really like as well, which goes along something like this, which is the hotter the battle, the sweeter the victory. Whereas the battle is probably not over yet, you certainly have been victorious. And this is really amazing. So thank you very much for going into this level of depth with us and sharing this personal story. So David, if we may touch on a few different points as well, something that we have alluded to in the beginning, which is why ultra rare conditions are really on a different spot nowadays when it comes to research and development and the general interest out there, the interest from the industry, pharmaceutical companies, and so on. Why is it a ultra-rare disease in such a tough spot at the current stage? Based on your experience, can you allude a little bit into that, on why are we not seeing ultra-rare diseases being taken as serious as any other conditions? Is it just the money problem? Or where's the gap coming from?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think a few different things. I think one, I've kind of made this point before, but I think having a patient group really helps for many things. I think it gives the condition like a face to the name. So if you search for occipital horn syndrome, there isn't really an awful lot. There's a few kind of journal abstracts, there's a few pictures, some of them are me. So there isn't really, it doesn't link you to anything. So it doesn't link you to like a patient group or, you know, charity or any kind, or like a university or anything that have got a real interest in it. So because it doesn't really have a face to it, I think that makes it difficult. You know, like I said, there's lots of ultra rare conditions where there are, albeit very small, but patient registries or patient groups. I think that really helps because it gives the name and a charity like a link together. Whereas if it doesn't have that, I think it's really difficult for people to take it seriously. You know, I understand that. I think that's one of the reasons why kind of the patient group might be the way forward at some point, but whether that's me doing it or somebody else at some point. I think as a business case, obviously, I understand why there's less interest from pharma. Because I mean, I think it always changes, but the amount of people that have my condition, it's really, really ultra rare. So because there's only a scattering of us, interested in doing anything or really taking it any further. It would be nice if it was more, I guess, kind of interest from sort of researchers and such, kind of in PhD students at universities and things. That's probably the way forward. But in terms of kind of actual pharmaceutical companies or biotech, I don't think that that will really change unless there was a real purpose. Because I can't see where it's going to go.
Right. And do you think that this is then, you know, the classic case where you would be hoping that governmental agencies and such public initiatives, they would jump in and fund research, fund the discovery of and the elaboration or development, I should say, of such programs that eventually could lead into breakthrough innovations in the treatment of ultra-rare diseases? Because, you know, from an industrial economic point of view, as you were saying, it's hard to make money on a handful of people, so to say, and having to invest millions of dollars to develop some sort of a treatment strategy. But that doesn't mean that we can just give up. Do you think that there has been a lack of governmental support in the past years, and should that change?
It's hard to answer this one. So I think that one of the things that a few people have actually said to me about that I've kind of met in the rare disease space was saying about, so I've mentioned Menkes disease, which is the much more severe version of what I have. And I've also mentioned Ehlers-Danlos, which is a similar condition. But the other condition that I haven't mentioned is something called Wilson syndrome. So Wilson syndrome is another rare disease. So my condition is not having enough copper. So it's connective tissue, but it's also a copper deficiency. Wilson syndrome is a surplus of copper. So it's the other way around. So the gene is very similar. So mine is called ATP7A and Wilson's has just got a B on the end of it. So something that some people have suggested is to kind of see what companies are working on Wilson syndrome, because if they're working on a condition that's very similar, they might be able to see something with my condition. Although there's a lot less people that have my condition, if they're working on kind of the opposite of my condition, there might be a way forward to do something. That's one way. You know, sometimes I've seen when there's been like a high profile, so like if a celebrity has kind of endorsed a different rare disease charity or something, that's tend to help with sort of raising a bit of a profile. I think that within the UK and within the US, there's sort of the bigger groups like Nord and Genetic Alliance over here and stuff. I think that when they highlight different groups or different conditions, that helps. But because, again, it's going back to the same thing of not having a community, it really, you know, because there's already so many other rare diseases that exist that have a registry, that have a patient group, it's all the same things that kind of come back again and again. Because I don't have that, you know, it's hard enough to get treatment for, or it's hard enough for kind of rare disease pharma companies to be able to, with kind of registered rare diseases or like, you know, ones where there's a group already. I just feel like I'm never going to win get anywhere with it, because it's just a numbers game and there's just not enough of us. So I just really don't think that there'll ever be anything. You know, I'm lucky that I live in the UK where we have an NHS, so we have a public health system. So I've never had to pay, you know, people that I meet in the US and stuff with insurance. You know, I'm not having, the way I see it is that although there isn't any real treatment as such, it's kind of just, you know, managing the conditions that I feel like I'm lucky that in a sense I'm not paying thousands and thousands of pounds every year to kind of have all this treatment. So, you know, I'm doing all the things that I can do, but I'm not really expecting anything, certainly not in my lifetime, to change, you know, for any real research into occipital. And maybe that might happen in 50 years and it might help another generation of people that have it. But I can't really think how that's going to change for now.
All right. So I was actually going to ask you the question. So how do we change that? How do we change this mentality? Because, you know, for you to tell me that you don't see how that's going to change in your lifetime, that really makes me, ooh. And, you know, if there's someone listening to that as well, they might feel discouraged because, you know, in spite of all of the positive things that we have been speaking about here and the inner strength and the pursuit of happiness, if you will, you are still in need of help at the end of the day. And if this help is not really coming, you know, some people might not have that mental strength that you have, and they might be, you know, really, really struggling and in losing hope to some extent. So how is there anything that you think we can do that could, even to a small extent, change this scene, let's say in a medium to long term?
Yeah, I'll answer it in two parts because I think that's probably the best way. So just kind of going back to my original point, I think that because my condition links to other conditions. And I've always been within the sort of hospitals that I go to. I've been going there for years. So I'm kind of known within the medical system. I think that that's an advantage for me because although I have this kind of really ultra rare condition and a thing on the side to that as well, although there isn't like a cure for it, there's at least different things that I can have to some extent. So I'm not forgotten about in terms of healthcare. It's more just in terms of research and development for the future. So I am very, you know, medically, I'm very well looked after. It's just that there isn't any research for any cures or potential cures for my condition. But I think in terms of like a broader picture, it would maybe be nice if some of the other companies maybe thought about ultra rare conditions a bit more. I know lots of companies do have an ultra rare kind of portfolio of conditions, but, you know, rare disease isn't just common rare disease. It's rare disease is literally lots of different things. So some of them are incredibly rare with one person in the world. Some of them are, you know, really, you know, ultra rare with a few dozen maybe, and then others are kind of tens of thousands. So rare disease is a very broad spectrum, I would call it, with lots of different conditions within that. And, you know, there's a lot of crossover, but, you know, they're all very different. But I think it's because if you think of pharma as a bigger picture, obviously there's lots of companies that work in rare disease now, which is great, but, you know, it's purely a numbers game. If it's something for asthma or diabetes, like really common conditions, they're obviously going to have more people and more interest in it. So I understand the business case, but it would be nice if there was more of a kind of push for these really ultra, ultra rare conditions, where I'm lucky in the sense that I can advocate for myself in many ways, maybe not for everything, but for a lot of things. Lucky that I live in the UK where there's a health system that helps me. I'm very fortunate for that. So, but you know, that's just me. I would hope that more people maybe from poorer parts of the world and where there isn't such a good healthcare, let alone sort of rare disease healthcare. So they're the people that I'm hoping can kind of get some sort of benefit from rare disease research and pharma companies. I think sort of healthcare inequality is a big issue now.
Right, absolutely. And David, maybe from a medical perspective, you have been interacting with doctors throughout your whole life. Can you comment a little bit, perhaps on that perspective? Do they actually feel, how frustrating is that for a physician who's, you know, giving everything that he has and try to, you know, provide you with the best possible treatment and still oftentimes come short because there's not a lot of tools in his bags? So can you comment a little bit on that as well from a physician's perspective, how challenging that actually is as well from a medical doctor?
Yeah, so I'm kind of throughout the years, so just for kind of context, so I was 26 when I had my formal diagnosis of occipital horn syndrome. When I was about 3, I had a kind of rough diagnosis of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. So even then, that obviously Ehlers-Danlos syndrome has become more well known now, but obviously sort of 30 years ago, it wasn't as well known. I've always kind of been in hospital settings where, you know, even Ehlers-Danlos was really kind of ultra rare at that time, or it certainly was in terms of awareness. So I've always been treated not necessarily as like a bigger picture. It's always been, I've had, you know, a doctor or doctors that look after my bladder, say, and then another set of doctors that look after my heart, another with my bowel, et cetera, et cetera. So I've always had, you know, excellent healthcare professionals looking after me and kind of managing what I have. But I think that they all find it frustrating. You know, I'm always kind of being asked, oh, can my medical students come into your appointments? And, you know, but when I've been in hospital, I'm always very happy to kind of help, because I think that they're educating kind of like the next generation of doctors, especially kind of rare disease doctors, you know, not just doctors, healthcare professionals generally. That's how they're going to learn, because they will learn so much more from seeing a rare disease patient in the flesh than they will just reading it in a textbook. So, but I think all of the people that I see, you know, find it frustrating because they want to do more as such. And, you know, there's only so much you can do. If you're living with a condition that's degenerative and kind of multidisciplinary in the sense that it affects lots of different parts of your body and it's so unpredictable, I think they find it frustrating. And, you know, things with sort of surgeries and kind of the same problems kind of coming back over and over again, you're only really putting a plaster over a hole. It's not really doing anything because it's the wall's always going to come back. So it's one of them things where you just have to kind of manage it day to day. But, you know, I'm very thankful that everyone that I do see, you know, I go to lots of the sort of most famous places in London and Cambridge that are, you know, rare disease centres. So I'm very lucky that, although, you know, like I said, I keep going back to the same point, but although there isn't any real research into my condition, at least kind of you know, organ by organ part of my body, you know, I'm really well looked after. But I do think they find it frustrating because, you know, they see lots of people with a rare disease, but some of them will have cures sort of slash treatment, some of them won't. So, but unfortunately, I fit into the bit that doesn't have a cure or such. But yeah, who knows? We'll see.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So I think, you know, educating and creating awareness is a big step moving forward and a much necessary step that we all need to take. And I think this is one of the reasons why we have created this podcast here, you know, to bring voices like yours into the public so that people have a closer look, a better understanding of some of these challenging conditions that most of us have never heard before. So on that note, David, I would like to close today's interview. I really, really appreciate your input, being open and sharing this beautiful story, the story of your life, your experience dealing with rare diseases. I truly wish you nothing but the best. And I really hope to meet you in person soon as well, whether it's in a convention, a conference, or even for a coffee in the UK. I live in Germany, so we're not that far away from each other. So I really, really appreciate your time. And yeah, have a great day.
Thank you very much, Raul. And thank you for everyone for tuning in. I hope you found it really interesting and very happy to kind of answer any follow-up questions that you might have. Thank you.
Enjoyed this podcast or have suggestions for future episodes and how we can make it better, please get in touch with us. You can email us at fewandfarbetween@biorassi.com or contact us at our website at biorassi.com.